beautiful, isn't it? The Silver Scroll Awards are tonight. They are a prestigious New Zealand songwriting award recognising outstanding achievement in the craft of song. Started in 1965, winners include Ray Columbus, Scribe P Money. Last year's award went to Aldous Harding with The Barrel. Now let's go back 24 years to 1996 with what must be one of the most recognisable songs ever to win. I'm not even going to tell you who the song's by. You should know if you don't. Find out. Do you know, Alan?
It's Big Rummer.
Who? Jenny, did you know that?
Yes, I did know that.
Beautiful, isn't it? Yeah. Their album, which featured the song, went 7 times platinum in New Zealand. You've got to say, of all the songs written in this country, that must be one of the most beautiful. What do you think, Alan?
Well, I remember actually seeing her on stage opening for the Finn Brothers down in Dunedin. It must have been about 1994. Probably. So I think that it was very early on in her career. And she just held the whole place mesmerised.
It was quite something, isn't it? Yeah. It is 25 to 5. The panel, RNZ National. Jenny Morton and Alan Blackman with me this afternoon. Over-the-counter sales of New Zealand's most popular painkiller could soon be restricted. Paracetamol. It's cheap. Is readily available. A coroner is calling for change following the death of a young student from liver damage caused by too much paracetamol. Alana Spanky was just 20 when she died of acute liver failure 3 years ago. Medical experts are looking at whether limiting how much paracetamol we can buy at supermarkets and chemists is the way to go. Countdown is already restricting sales. In a recent University of Otago study found a third of New Zealanders' households have 30 grams or more. That's 60 pills at home. With us is the Medical Director of the Royal New Zealand College of General Practitioners, Dr. Brian Betty. Dr. Betty, kia ora, welcome.
Afternoon. Well, it's nice to be here.
Good to have you on. This is a really tragic death, this. But look, as I understand, it's an otherwise very safe drug in the prescribed dosage. Is that right?
Look, that's exactly right. And yeah, this tragic event has really highlighted the problem with paracetamol, that if you take it at the prescribed dosage, or the maximum dosage of 2 tablets 4 times a day, which is 8 tablets a day, very, very safe, very effective painkiller, no problems. It's when you take excess to that, either over time or as a single dose in an overdose type situation, it is potentially fatal. And very damaging, in that it can affect the liver. Yeah.
I read one comment that it is surprisingly easy to go past that prescribed dose if you have an episode or if you have a moment in life, actually as I have, when you're in real pain, there might be some temptation to take more than the packet says, which is a big issue.
Well, we actually see that. So I see patients all the time who have doubled up their dose of paracetamol because they think it'll give them extra pain relief. And look, it actually doesn't, because the dose is the dose. But it actually can actually cause this very potentially severe side effect of liver damage. And I don't think that's very, very well understood in the general community, because we have had this situation where paracetamol is freely available at supermarkets, maybe the dairy or garage or whatever, and that people don't perceive it as a potentially dangerous medication.
Good heavens. So would you say that we need a little more awareness on this in general? I mean, the issues of going above the 8 tablets a day, as you said, is not something you hear a lot about, given the ramifications.
Oh, 100%. I think it does need to be more widely out there that there are problems with paracetamol in excess. But I think we fall into this trap in terms of it being freely available across the counter, that you fall into this trap to think, well, you know, it's a safe medication, it's a good medication. Yeah, if I take some extra tablets, does it really matter? Well, the answer is actually yes. And that really does need to be out in the front of mind, I think, of people when they're using paracetamol and thinking about its use and thinking about where they're using it.
Jenny, you ever thought on this?
Well, I'm just wondering, you know, I know it probably does say it on the packet, but there's a lot of small print on those packets. You know, shouldn't it be like a warning on the front of the packet that says overuse of this, more use, you know, greater use than the suggested dosage? It could kill you.
Is that one of the solutions, Brian?
Look, it potentially could be, and certainly that's one of the things that MedSafe, which is the government body that looks at these things, perhaps needs to consider, that perhaps there needs to be more of a warning about taking the medication in excess, as well as the move that's underway to try and restrict the amount that you can actually purchase across the counter.
When that restriction comes into play, is that a bit like it does go into a database so that if someone really wanted to go around three different pharmacies and buy excess amounts, that could be stopped? Or is it just in any one point of sale you can't buy more than a certain amount?
Yeah, I think it's any one point of sale you can't buy any more than a certain amount. Anyone wanting to go around different pharmacies to get more paracetamol could possibly do that because it's an over-the-counter medication that is, you don't require a script for it. It sort of does just, I think, just give that sort of consciousness that it is, you know, a medication that you do have to respect.
Brian, do you think that making it prescription only would be a possibility here, one way of getting around this?
Look, that's something that has been suggested. However, it may be a step too far in terms of where we are with paracetamol, because most people do use it appropriately. They either use it for short term, I've got a headache, a couple of paracetamol, or, you know, I've hurt my ankle, it'll work. So I think the majority of people do use it appropriately. So I think prescription only may be a step too far. I think the restriction idea is probably the better space to be in at this point.
Right. Yeah, I'm just noting that study where a third of New Zealanders have 60 pills at home, and I recall reading one poison specialist said that many don't realise that self-poisoning is often impulsive. It's an impulsive act. So if you're having a bit of an acute crisis, you might be in a vulnerable state. Access to large amounts of medicines is risky. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, look, I do agree with that. In that situation where you are vulnerable in that particular situation, and overdose can be a very impulsive act that actually occurs. A couple of things with paracetamol, to be aware of, it's a dose of about 15 to 20 tablets that can actually be fatal. So it's not many tablets that you take in one go that can be fatal. However, the key thing about it is, if you do take those tablets, you've essentially got 48 hours to 72 hours to get to a hospital because there is an antidote to paracetamol poisoning.
Okay.
There's an infusion that can be given that can reverse it. However, if you move past 48 hours to 72 hours, it becomes irreversible and basically leads to liver failure.
Dr. Brian Betty, thank you very much for that.
I guess it's not as rare as you might think, because sort of reading up around this, so there's about 150 deaths in the UK every year from paracetamol, and in Australia over the last 10 years there's been 200 deaths, so it's not an isolated thing, really.
As a chemistry professor, is this something that's been on your radar? Or
I'd certainly known about it, but I guess I was unaware that there'd been any fatalities. I knew that you really shouldn't go over the stated dose, but yeah, no, it can be nasty, obviously, so...
19 to 5, you're on the panel, RNZ National. Jenny Morton and Alan Blackman with me this afternoon. Or to Sweden, where a devastating second wave has forced a dramatic rethink to their relaxed approach to COVID-19. Sweden has now seen a doubling in cases in 3 weeks, hitting more than 1,000 new cases in one day for the first time since June. So restrictions are being put in place. Auckland University epidemiologist Professor Rod Jackson told The Detail, RNZ, that Sweden has failed, calling it one of the worst possible outcomes you can imagine. They should have had zero deaths, and yet they've got 6,000 deaths, Professor Jackson said. John Byrne is a New Zealander who lives in Sweden with his family. John, welcome.
Thanks, Wallace. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you on the show here in New Zealand. Now tell me, what's it like living in Sweden at the moment, knowing this pandemic is in full swing?
Well, we're sort of, the way it's been set up here, we're not scared. We just... living life as normal. We've had no drastic changes make us feel scared. You rarely see a mask about. I went to the gym today and there was a lot of people in the gym. Beforehand there was treadmills that were every second treadmill you could use. Today, every treadmill was full. We're just going on as normal, it feels like.
Mm. And in terms of COVID, you were saying that it's got to the stage where everyone knows someone who has got the virus.
It's getting closer. We've had three letters from the Health Ministry of Health saying, like, there's someone in the children's class or work colleagues got COVID. And today my son and wife got tested. So it's getting closer, it feels.
And what do Swedes think about all this?
It's a really hard question. It's really hard to put your finger on it. As I said, we haven't made any drastic changes, so there's a lot of people that are working from home. Other people, like myself, my wife, we go to work every day. The children go to school. We just don't socialise and don't have anyone in the house. I haven't seen my mother-in-law. I've seen her once this year, which could be a blessing in disguise, but, you know, it's just in such a low-key approach what's happening. If anything, last week the recommendations were that beforehand we're only allowed to have 30 people go to concerts or sporting events. Or, sorry, 50. Now it's been raised to 300. So the messages are really mixed.
Right. Tell me, John, does it make you concerned at all for you and your family? You say that your family has got tested, but I think you also said it was actually quite hard just to get tested. Are you concerned at all?
Last week there was a breakdown somewhere in the lab, so they could only test 60 people a day in the town I'm in. I'm in a town about the size of Dunedin, 120,000. This week it's back to normal. So, yeah, I am concerned. You always feel about governments, the information they release is what they want you to hear. And the messages are mixed all the time. I don't trust the government 100%, but that's just probably my own paranoia. But, it's just really hard to put your finger on who's telling the truth. There's so many conspiracy theories out there, what's going on, and all we can do is just wash your hands and keep a little social distance yourself and try to protect your family.
And carry on. Is there much news of New Zealand in your part of the world?
There's a lot about the elections. And New Zealand is portrayed as a very positive outcome. It's been really good. There's little snippets here and there. But it's the polar opposite of what's happening here. You think of New Zealand, lock the borders. We couldn't lock our borders. We're just so fluid with borders, you know, other countries around us. And the way they talk about how they're going to deal with it is they have to cope with a marathon, not a sprint. That's sort of the message. We're here for the long run. So I suppose they're trying to just limit the damage and try to get through it without locking us down and causing economic damage.
Finally, John, are you tempted at all? I think you've been, 6 years there in Sweden, tempted to come home?
I don't think it's possible. I have a great life here. Sweden is a wonderful country. I love it here. At this point, if I could choose between living in both countries while this is going on, I'd definitely choose New Zealand. I think what's happened there and the way the country's got behind everything, it's been incredible. And the reason I came to Sweden apart was because I felt New Zealand was isolated. It was away from the rest of the world, and I loved Europe. Now, you sort of have to question, you know, why you came back. And that isolation could be the reason I want to come back.
John, nice to have you on the program. Yeah, nice to have you on the program, and appreciate your time.
It's great to talk to you again, Wallace, and thank you. Thank you for considering talking to me. It's great.
That is John Byrne. He's a New Zealander who lives in Sweden. He's actually lived in Sweden for about 6 years now. Absolutely loves it. But it's amazing when you think of Europe and across the whole of Europe. It'll be some time before we ever get to go there again, right, Alan?
Yeah, I know. It's sad. It's going to be a horrible winter for them over there. I heard a joke recently about the Swedes that they'd brought in 2 metre social distancing or something recently, and all the Swedes were complaining and they wanted to get back to their normal 5 or 6 metre.
Now, I must say that we've had some really... I just got to say thank you for your feedback on all the topics, but particularly paracetamol, where we've had... I'm really glad I raised it because a lot of people didn't seem to realise the severity of overdosing. Can I just read this one from Lisa? Friends and family, dear Wallace, friends and family were heartbroken to have to watch our dear, vibrant and successful friend die over several days following a paracetamol overdose. His organs shut down, a transplant or other treatments, it wasn't viable. His children and loved ones came to say goodbye, and the ever-resilient CDHB staff were in tears. We'll never forget it. Please restrict at point of sale, but education must be a large part of the answer. Lisa, thank you very much for getting in touch with us.
Wow.
12 to 5, the panel, RNZ. Now, if you think you're going for the healthy option when you choose a diet fizzy drink, you may need to think again. An ongoing study published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology has found that artificially sweetened drinks may be just as bad for your heart as a sugar-laden fizzy drink. Dr. Simon Thornley is a public health physician from the University of Auckland whose research interests include epidemiological methods, low carbohydrate and low sugar approaches to diet. He's a spokesperson, co-spokesperson for the advocacy group Fizz, who fights sugar in soft drink. Dr. Thornley, welcome to the program.
Wallace, thanks for having me.
What did you make of the findings of the study?
Very interesting study. It shows a small increase in risk. It's around about 20% increase in risk of heart disease comparing people who are women who have lots of artificially sweetened drinks with those who have never or less than once a week. So in terms of the big picture, it's relatively weak epidemiological evidence that artificially sweetened drinks are problematic. If you look at all the models right. that are presented, the increase in risk is not particularly consistent. And when we also think of some of the trials that have been done, this is an observational study, we know that if you take teenagers who drink sugary drinks, there's a very good trial evidence that if you take their sugary drinks and replace them with artificially sweetened drinks, they actually do better, and that's at 2 years in terms of lower metabolic risk factors and lower weight. So we need to interpret the study in light of all the other evidence that we know.
So as it said, it's more associative to establish that causal link. Other investigations are needed. So because you often hear, don't you, about artificial sweeteners and that type of thing, but really the focus, I guess in your view, still needs to be on the sugar in drinks
yes.
across the board.
There's a similar study. It's interesting. There was a study from Yang, which was put out about 5 years ago, which considered the association between sugar and heart disease in an American survey. And the difference in risk between the low and the high groups was about 140%. So that's quite a strong association in epidemiological terms, whereas if we look at the difference in risk between the high and the low in the artificial drink study, it's about 20%. So there's a vast difference there, and we're more likely to attribute causation to very strong associations than the weak association that we see here.
Jenny, you got a question?
Well, no, I don't, but I get really worried about these surveys and things because I just think that there's so much. Why are we selling this stuff? Why are we selling Fanta and Coke and all these things and dairies next to schools?
It's tasty.
Yeah, but geez, they're not really good for us.
I'm just saying, the odd Fanta can be quite tasty. Alan Blackman, you got a question for Simon?
I mean, this is a big study. There are 104,760 participants, and they were looking at them over 13 years or so, I think. So, you probably can't quibble about the numbers and everything, but as you say, it looks like a weak-ish correlation, but there does appear to be some sort of correlation there.
Yes, well, that's an interesting aspect of large studies, is that it's very hard not to get a statistically significant result. So even very small differences can look dramatic when you look at the p-value in large studies. So mm-hmm. I think it's a bit of a trick for young players there. In terms of why are we making sugar, why is it so available, I think, the country needs to look hard at whether we should go the UK's way in terms of taxing sugary drinks. I totally agree.
All right. Dr. Simon Thornley, thank you very much for your time there. to this yesterday on the panel. We talked about veggie burgers and whether they count as real burgers. Well, today we're talking about the butchers as the winners of the Great New Zealand Sausage Competition, which has been crowned. This year, the Producer of the Decade Award was included for the first time. And the honour went to Chris Timms, owner of Peter Timms Meats in Christchurch, who hopefully will be joining us very soon. They won for consistently producing high-quality medal-winning sausages over the last decade. Before we have Chris join us around the panel, are you a fan of the odd sausage? Alan?
No, I'm not going to lie. No, sausages can be really, really good.
Old school, just the usual old school mashed potato, or do you like the gourmet types? Or
actually, the thing I haven't had in years is crumbed sausages that my mum used to make for dinner. Oh, they were so good. This is way back many, many, many years ago.
But, nice,
Jenny?
I quite like a sausage occasionally, but I have had Peter Timms, as Chris Timms' business is called, sausages, and they are very, very good.
Oh, are they now? All right.
Peter Timms Meats is a bit of an institution in Christchurch.
Is it?
Oh, yeah. Oh. You go into their shop, especially on a Saturday morning, it's full of people, you know, buying wonderful, you know, beautifully presented meats. I always go there for lamb shanks.
Is it a butcher? Because one of the reasons I wanted to get Chris on was the state of the local butcher. They really do seem to be a bit of a disappearing breed. Mm. And there are several that are well regarded, aren't there? But really, I mean, Alan, do you have a local butchery in your area that you?
No. It's, you know, just the supermarket, really. I think any butchers who are still going, they must be really, really good. You know, you've got to have a reason to go to them, I think, because the supermarket's too damn easy.
We're talking a queue at the counter here to get your
meat. Wow, really?
And it is. It's a really good butcher's. But Peter Timms Meats, their sausages are also available in supermarkets. Gosh, I'm doing a really good plug for them here, aren't I? you go into their shop in Edgware and it's always plenty
of
people in there.
But do you go out of your way to actually go to a dedicated butchery?
I will for lamb shanks.
Yeah. Well, I don't think that Chris, I don't think that the Peter Timms Meats person is going to be joining us, actually. We're trying to get hold of him. If you are listening in, Chris, pick up that phone so we can have a talk to you and congratulate you on your award.
But he'll be busy serving customers in that shop. That's probably the story. He'll be flat out.
He'll be flat out. Do you think so? We talked yesterday, one of the reasons why we wanted to get another opinion on the types of food people eat, Alan, and yesterday we talked about veggie burgers and vegetable meats.
Yeah. I, when I was in China once upon a time, in Xi'an, I got taken to a restaurant that was fully vegetarian, but they dressed it up as meat. So it looked like a steak that you're eating. It looked like rissoles and everything, but it was purely vegetarian. So all of the fat along the side of the steak was gelatin or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it just tasted like meat. It was quite remarkable. Absolutely incredible. You wouldn't know you weren't eating meat. Amazing.
Tasty?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yep. So I don't know how they did it, but it was all
vegetable. So you're a supporter, Jenny Morton, are you a supporter of plant-based meats yourself?
Look, I'm a bit of a supporter of plant-based diets. I was vegan for about a year until I gave up because I found it too hard, which shows how, once again, how shallow I can be. but I don't kind of get the thing, if you choose to be plant-based, why you're trying to eat something that resembles meat. I mean, if you like plant-based food and it tastes good and you can make some amazing meals and people do.
Right.
I don't kind of get the idea of trying to make it seem like meat.
Okay, well, let's have Chris Timms is on now. He's the owner of Peter Timms Meats. And we've been talking about you, Chris.
Oh, have you? I've got it.
Yeah. What, have you been busy? You've been busy serving customers.
Yeah, no, busy working here.
Whoa! Congratulations! What's the secret? What's some of the most popular sausages there?
We've got quite a few actually. We do quite a few. We do a German bratwurst, a hot Hungarian, which is pretty popular, and a Spanish chorizo.
Okay.
Most popular ones we've got there.
Right, yeah, Jenny here on the panel, Chris, says that you're a bit of a local identity in terms of butcheries. But I wanted to ask you, in terms of the destination butcher's stores, there's still a market for them? Because in an era where they're declining, there is still a market for a good local butchery?
Definitely. I mean, it's one of those arts that, you know, the good ones that survive. And we've got a good, quite a few, good butcheries in Christchurch, and it's a tribute to having all those sort of awards.
Yeah,
recognise all those people that, you know, sort of good job they're doing.
How long have you been going?
Long time.
Yeah,
long time.
1886.
Been in it for a while. Yeah.
Good on you, Chris. All right, Alan, thank you very much. Jenny, thank you very much. It's been wonderful having you both on the panel. Thank you. I'm Wallace Chapman. See you for Thursday, 3:45. Bye.